Propagandy, propagandy. If you want to fool the folks, it comes in handy. If you want to tell some lies, pull the wool over their eyes, you can do it with propagandy. Propagandy, propagandy. You can liberate the babies from their candy. It's so easy, it's a sin, you're gonna want to jump right in. You can always depend on propagandy. Life is so hard, so confusing. Everyone's just trying to make ends meet. You can brighten up their day, keep the facts out of their way. Just simplify the complex, repeat, repeat, repeat. Propagandy, propagandy. If you need to change a subject, it's a dandy. If you want to wag the dog, it's like falling off a log. It's so easy with propagandy. Propagandy, propagandy. Try and convince the folks the beach is never sandy. You can convert into lies what they seen with their own eyes. It's amazing, propagandy. Life is so complex, so confusing. Everyone's just trying to make ends meet. You can brighten up their day, keep the facts out of their way. Just simplify the complex, repeat, repeat, repeat. Propagandy, propagandy. Goes down easy like a snifter of old brandy. Gotta learn how to tinker with that hook, line, and sinker for easy to swallow propagandy. If you want to stir the pot, make it look like you're not. Just add a shot of propagandy. If you want to rule the roost and you need a little boost, I recommend propagandy. Propagandy.
Thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with the trouble with climate. The National Climate Assessment is in, and it says that humans could be responsible for temperatures rising as much as 10 degrees by 2100. Steve Curwood talks with Carol Browner about this. And then after that is A Bright Future for Healthcare Possible. Dr. Donald Berwick, who studied management of healthcare systems to improve the trade-offs among quality, safety, and costs, concludes that any healthcare funding plan that is just, equitable, and civilized and humane must be redistributional from the rich among us to the poor and less fortunate. And then after that, chemicals that promote obesity down the generations. Diet and exercise are seen as a key factor that cause obesity, but new research suggests that certain chemicals called obesogens contribute to the global weight problem. Bruce Bloomberg at University of California tells Steve Curwood that the effects of an obesogen chemical he studied seem to persist for several generations.
The U.S. government recently released a draft of its third national climate assessment, saying that human activity is the primary cause of climate change. The report warns that if emissions go unchecked, global temperatures could rise as much as 10 degrees by the end of the century. It also details the impacts global warming is expected to have and has already had on American lives. Carol Browner is a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. A former head of the EPA, she served President Obama for 2 years as the director of the White House Office of Energy and Climate Change Policy. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you.
So, Carol Browner, what's most important about this assessment?
Well, I think what this assessment tells us yet again is that something is happening. Something quite dramatic is happening, something that requires our attention. It's getting hotter, the storms are getting worse, and there's a huge amount of scientific consensus about the need for action.
The report seemed to amp up the certainty, though, from earlier versions talked about very likely to, hey, humans really are the principal cause. What do you make of that?
I think that's right. I think that the scientists do what scientists do. They continue to study, and this time what they're saying to us is the science is even clearer that it is human activities that are contributing to these changes in the climate and that we need to do something. Now, obviously, this is a draft assessment. It will be subjected to, public comment, and then they'll issue a final report. But it seems highly likely that the final report will really take this very significant step of saying that the science is just increasingly clear and that we need to act.
What immediate action do President Obama and the Congress need to take on climate change, given the findings of this comprehensive report?
Well, I think it's important to know the president has taken some action. Certainly the work he did with the car companies to establish the first ever greenhouse gas emissions, the fuel efficiency standards, hugely important in terms of getting some reductions in that industry. I think the next step is obviously smokestacks, and there the administration has proposed standards for new smokestacks, new power plants, but I think the real issue are the existing power plants, and I think we will see the administration propose something and the EPA take action, and the degree to which we can achieve real and measurable reductions from fossil fuel burning power plants will be important in terms of starting to bend down, if you will, the level of emissions.
There's one call for action for the president from advocates who say that the Keystone XL pipeline should not go forward. That would move the produce of tar sands into the market and into the atmosphere and would have, they say, a strong effect on climate disruption. What sense does it make for the federal government to support this project given this climate assessment's predictions?
The question in front of the administration is the actual siting of the pipeline, and I suspect that the State Department, who has ultimate decision-making, will look very, very carefully at the sites that have been proposed. But, the concerns that the activists raise are legitimate concerns, which is we're going to take a fuel that will only contribute to greenhouse gas emissions and extract it and ship it.
The activists are pointing to the Keystone XL pipeline controversy as a litmus test for the president. They say if he's really serious about addressing climate change, he won't let his administration go forward with facilitating the extraction of tar sands.
I don't know that one single decision is a litmus test. I think you have to look at what he's done, what he is prepared to do. I think that this is a president who has believed that we have a real opportunity to change our energy, that we create a clean energy future. We've seen huge investments in renewables. We've seen growth in renewables. Obviously, all of us would like to go more quickly, but we are starting to make measurable progress, and I think the president will do more things in his second term.
So if you were still at the White House running energy and climate policy, what would you say the United States now has to do to protect its people and economy from what's coming in terms of climate disruption?
Well, I think we have to do two things. One, we have to continue to reduce emissions. I think we also have to begin a very serious and thoughtful conversation about resiliency and adaptation. I would prefer we didn't get to this place, but the reality is we need to begin to think through, and storms like Sandy are certainly reminders, how do we redevelop, in the case of Sandy, rebuild? How do we develop into the future to ensure that what we now understand are likely to be a climate impact won't cause us to invest poorly, but rather that we think about these challenges and we invest accordingly. So, for example, you don't build in a floodplain. You don't destroy the marshes in a floodplain because those marshes actually do a really good job of absorbing the storm surge. Nature's pretty good at helping itself if we allow it to.
The report points out that there are synergies in dealing with these problems. For example, long-term emissions reductions may not feel like it has an immediate payoff, but if it comes in the form of reducing pollution, say, from power plants, there's an immediate impact on human health. How do you think the administration should frame these choices, particularly in these times of tight budget constraints?
Well, I think that's exactly right, that when we reduce emissions from smokestacks, when we reduce emissions from tailpipes, not only will we see climate benefits, but we'll also see public health benefits. So, for example, one of the things the administration did, one of the things Lisa Jackson did, was set a new fine particle standard. What we know is little tiny fine particles are very dangerous, particularly for older Americans. They can contribute to premature deaths. They're a byproduct of burning fossil fuels in many instances. And so the degree to which we're reducing the use of fossil fuels, the degree to which we're reducing emissions associated with fossil fuels, those reductions have immediate, real, and measurable consequences, in this case, particularly older Americans.
Lamar Smith, who is a Republican from Texas, he chairs the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, said after this report came out that he believes that climate change is due to a combination of factors, including natural cycles, sunspots, and human activity, but scientists still don't know for certain how much each of these factors contribute to overall climate change that the Earth is experiencing. In other words, we're not certain that there's a problem here. This is a political problem to go ahead. How do you deal with it?
Look, maybe you don't believe climate change is real, okay? I think it's real. The president thinks it's real. But that doesn't mean there aren't other reasons to be doing this. There is a green energy revolution in the world. There is no reason why the United States can't be at the forefront of that, why we can't be making the best technologies, creating the jobs here in the United States, and shipping that technology around the world.
Carol Browner was the climate czar for the Obama administration, is now a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington. Thank you so much, Carol.
Thank you.
Coming up next, from the movie, The Lion in Winter, Queen Eleanor Lectures Her Sons on World Peace, delivered by Katharine Hepburn.
A knife! He's got a knife!
Of course he has a knife. He always has a knife. We all have knives. It's 1183 and we're barbarians. How clear we make it. Oh, my piglets, we are the origins of war. Not history's forces, nor the times, nor justice, nor the lack of it, nor causes, nor religions, nor ideas, nor kinds of government, nor any other thing. We are the killers. We breed wars. We carry it like syphilis inside. Dead bodies rot in field and stream because the living ones are rotten. For the love of God, can't we love one another just a little? That's how peace begins. We have so much to love each other for. We have such possibilities, my children. We could change the world.
Coming up next is A Bright Future for Healthcare Possible. Dr. Donald Berwick, who studies the management of healthcare systems to improve the trade-offs among quality, safety, and cost, concludes that any healthcare funding plan that is just, equitable, and civilized and humane must redistribute wealth from the richer to the poorer and the less fortunate.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which together with the Lundberg Institute has organized tonight's event. Now, I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco, our live audience, and also our online audiences, both online on our podcast and also on the radio. And we invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Now, tonight's speaker is Donald Berwick. Has a long-time connection with the president of the Lundberg Institute, so I wanted you to know about the background of the Lundberg Institute and why he invited, or why it was Dr. Berwick was invited tonight. So the Lundberg Institute was started by George Lundberg, former editor of JAMA magazine, and a long history in policy-oriented medical solutions. And he started the Lundberg Institute with this policy. It was founded to promote patient-centered care. One doctor, one patient, one moment, one decision. Let it be a shared decision informed by the best evidence and considering cost. So that's the mission statement for the Lundberg Institute. Dr. Berwick has put an entire career into very similar programs. He is the former president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He's a former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. He's a pediatrician, and he was on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Berwick is going to speak to us tonight about, is a bright future for healthcare possible? Thank you very much. Dr. Berwick.
Thank you. Thank you, George. Dr. Lundberg, it's an honor to be here speaking in a lectureship with your name on it. George Lundberg has been a close friend and mentor of mine for many, many years and a giant in the healthcare world as a publisher, thinker, and guide to our ethics and our science. So thank you very much, George. I'm going to be giving you a rather technical lecture, and I thought I should probably begin with a little bit of stage setting so you can track it. It's a very raucous time in healthcare right now, as you probably know. It's fraught. We'll deal with some of how it's fraught in a few minutes. It's a time when I think the country is going to make a lot of very serious choices, and the main choice, the one that I'm focused on, is the choice between improving care and cutting care. Healthcare has become unsustainable in the macroeconomic scene. Even if it weren't, there are many defects in the kind of care we have in our country, all repairable. Everything is doable. Everything can be improved. And we could get out of this problem with sufficient attention to making healthcare become the kind of system it should be, which it isn't yet. That will involve tremendous changes, and those changes meet resistance in the status quo. If we don't change healthcare, what will happen is pretty nasty. We're going to see cuts in the safety net, cuts in the benefit structures of our healthcare coverage, continuing defects in care, and a rather unfortunate future for care in a wealthy and vibrant country that deserves and can have better. This is the topic I'm going to address with you tonight in my more formal remarks. For 30 years, my career has been devoted to Plan A, the improvement plan. And the speech I'm going to give you was actually first delivered to a group of followers of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, the organization that I started and led for 20 years. Before I went to Washington as CMS administrator. What I was saying to that group and will say to you is that we have a problem right now, an opportunity and a responsibility all around change, all around making healthcare become what it can be, but the improvement movement, which reflects quite a substantial minority of the healthcare system, but many, many people trying to improve care all the time, is at a turning point. And so my talk is about that turning point, and it's about an issue, I think, of maturation. I'm a pediatrician, I think, in terms of maturation. And it's about courage, because the improvement movement is facing a coming to terms now with realities that we all might rather avoid. That's what I'm going to talk to you about. The talk is technical. I know many of you in the audience are friends of mine and are well-schooled in healthcare delivery and improvement. Others of you are not of that background and might be a bit challenged by the technical content. That's why we're going to have a question and answer period at the end, and hope feel free to for me to clarify my thinking. For comfort, I'm going to start with my family. I often do. This is my grandson, Nathaniel. This is Nathaniel just before I went to Washington to run CMS in 2009. He had just been born. Here he is in 2010. He's 1 year old. And this is Nathaniel in 2011, age two. At this age, a year ago, he was walking. He knew about 100 words. Like most two-year-olds, he could name four body parts. He could count to five. He could stack five or six blocks up. This is Nathaniel recently. He's 3 years old now. A big difference here. This summer, one day during the Red Sox debacle here on the West Coast, you may not have suffered as we did. It was awful. Nathaniel was on the swings at the playground, and he didn't want to leave. And so my daughter's fiance, Joey, tried to coax him. Joey said, come on, the Red Sox are on TV. We can see Big Poppy play. Big Poppy is the Red Sox designated hitter, David Ortiz. Nathaniel's answer, and you got to remember, this kid couldn't say one single sentence a year before. His answer was, no, we can't see Big Poppy. Big Poppy's on the DL, the disabled list. This photo is of Nathaniel with Big Poppy. Now, I am not saying Nathaniel is a genius. He is a genius, but that's not the point of my story. What I'm saying is, wow, where did this come from? Child development, it sneaks up on you like bread rising in an oven. It's a great joy being a pediatrician to get to interact and see this happen. It's also one of the joys of the other part of my life, which is watching the healthcare improvement movement, the movement I was just telling you about. Over and over again, I've seen things happen and wonder where it came from. I'll give you some historical examples. About maybe 30 years ago, when I was first getting into the field, this was in 1985, I met with a group of orthopedic surgeons, I remember, and they were forming a quality assurance committee. And I, being very interested now in the world of improvement, said, why don't you call it a quality improvement committee? At which point one of the orthopedists stood up and said, we really can't do that, because if we did that, people might think we were doing something wrong now. That would be a different story nowadays, I think. Here's another story. Same year, or 82 or 83, I think it was. I was collecting patient satisfaction data at the HMO that I worked at in those days, the Harvard Community Health Plan. And I went to a departmental meeting and passed out the reports on satisfaction, doctor by doctor. And one of the doctors, Carol, a close friend of mine, she stood up in the back of the room. She crumpled her feedback report into a ball. She threw it at me, and she walked out of the room. Today would be different. 30 years ago, we didn't know that patient safety was a problem. We do now. Healthcare infections, we thought, just came with the territory. Patient-centered care meant maybe a focus group or two. Most doctors were laughing in those days at checklists, at cookbook medicine. That was then. This is now, and now is different. For example, you may not know this, but in the nation as a whole, we have tackled the problem of central venous line infections. When you put a central line in a patient to feed them or give them toxic drugs, that's plastic in the venous system, and it can get infected with bacteria, and bacteria love to grow on foreign bodies, and they spread around the body and can kill you. When I was in training in internal medicine, which I did before PEDS, lots of patients died of bacteremia. We now know it can be eliminated with proper attention to detail in management of the central line. And nationally, we've reduced central line infections 53% in the entire country in intensive care units. That's from the improvement movement. Patient safety has become a big effort. When I was CMS administrator, we launched the Partnership for Patients, a $1 billion investment in making patient care safer all over the country. Patient-centered care is a reality now in some places. We need more attention to it, but we're starting to do things like do away with visiting hours and welcoming in loved ones and asking people more how they would like their care to be. Checklists are now much more adopted. They make you safe in certain environments, not always, but we now are using them. Julie Klieger is in the audience. She's been a leader in the sepsis work that's gone on across the country. Julie led a program in the Bay Area here with 9 hospitals that reduced deaths from sepsis, septicemia, bacteria in bloodstream, by 55%. Done here just in the past couple of years. IHI, the organization that I ran before I went to CMS, started something called the IHI Open School for Health Professions. It welcomes young people in a virtual environment, Facebook and social networking, to learn about improvement as the doctors, nurses, pharmacists, healthcare managers, engineers of the future. The IHI Open School, when I left to go to CMS, it had about 12,000 students networked together. As of this week, we're at 117,000 students in 55 countries with over 500 chapters. So there's a robust change process underway. That's good news. But there's bad news. And the bad news is that that work's not done. It's not even close to done. From the viewpoint of scale, from the viewpoint of getting changes in healthcare everywhere that could solve our problem, achieve what the IHI calls the triple aim, better care, better health, and lower cost, that could basically deal with our reeling economies, the angry payers, the disappointed patients, the fretful politicians, we're miles from home. And so this year, my first year out of CMS, I've been going around the country wondering what's in the way, what has us stuck? Why aren't we a nation on the move to better care at lower cost, which is technically achievable? And I came to a tough conclusion that I'm going to talk to you about. The conclusion is that it is fear. We're scared of the truth. The next wave of change in American healthcare, which we badly need in order to avoid that other scenario of cutting care, it crosses some veiled and very scary landscape, and I'm going to tell you about that landscape. First, I want to show you a picture that I got from my friend Scott Weingarten, the CEO of Zinc, just about to move to Cedars-Sinai. Scott sent me this photo, which shows a bridge in 1938 in Honduras. It's a strong bridge, the Choluteca River Bridge, built by American Bridge Company, at that time a masterpiece of engineering strength. It's in Honduras, and it has to be strong in Honduras because Honduras tests strength. The weather's bad there, and especially in 1995 when Hurricane Mitch came to Honduras. Mitch was a killer hurricane, one of the worst on record. It killed many people. It also killed bridges. It took down 150 Honduran bridges. They fell during Mitch, but not the Choluteca River Bridge. This is the devastation at Tegucigalpa by Hurricane Mitch. But the Choluteca River Bridge survived just one problem. The river moved. The photograph you're seeing has the river now in a different place from where the bridge is. It was in the right place, but now it's in the wrong place. This is American healthcare. Not totally so, but because the river still runs under the bridge we built, the one we built for biotechnology, for audacity, for miracles. We need intensive care units. We need surgery suites. We need organ transplants. We need complex cancer care. Kids died when I was in training of acute lymphoblastic leukemia, always. Now they live. They have their hearts repaired if they have congenital heart disease.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Business everywhere runs the country through your hair. Lay my life on the line to dare. All these posers everywhere. Business in your face. Profit making every place. Even rebel music's laced. Time to give those fakes a taste. Who made business of the earth? Determined its godly worth. Time to put it in a hearse before this place really bursts. Business everywhere. Babies use the word before they learn to walk the stairs. Anybody here say World Trade Organization? Perpetuating, exploiting peoples, tribes, and nations. Let's see if we can see how far back bad business started. Long before the pharaohs and the day the sea was parted. When Moses led the slaves through the waves to be saved. But tell me, did things really change? Look around the world, the top down, it's getting awful strange. Bad business getting poor people in a tizziness. Makes them want to blow up Babylon so high it's dizziness. Business at the center of the WTO. World Trade, what? OWTC center? You know, a disaster. Business making pollution grow faster. Made a crook of the doctor and the pastor. Took the president and made of him a bastard and sells to you the rip-off rapper on your ghetto blaster. Who wants money first and justice second? I'm wrecking this. Throw the merchants out of church. They're begging for a king-size downfall. Beggars in the street because of y'all. Let it be known that dirty business made the world trade fall. Not terrorism, but businessism itself. Like the media putting war flicks on your shelf. A lot of wealth in your daily news and TV too. Papers, capers, congressmen are just escapers. It's true. Yeah. Oh, while the refugees go do 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 do. Business everywhere earns the country through your hair. Lay my life on the line to dare. All these posers everywhere. Business in your face. Profit making every place. Even rebel music's laced. Time to give those fakes a taste. Who made business of the earth? Determined its godly worth. Time to put it in a hearse before this place really bursts. Thank you. Maybe I can put this differently. The new world order is gonna get hurt just by being me. Cause I ain't seen nothing but hype, no controversy. And so it looks like this time it might have to be me. So, yeah, confidentially, it's my personal business how the Rockstar gets fame. Exploiting poor folks to get rich, so tell me who's to blame. Shame on you, you poser, wake up, party's over. Kill the Land Rover, army buggy, sold the world over. Yeah, the world is soon to be over. The way this here deal's going down, that's why it's my personal business how the Bush and Cheney families been doing business with the Hussein Laden families. And getting fights when things don't go quiet, right, you see? And whip up wars when they need profits for the military. The chickens already came home to roost. The cat is out the bag with teeth sharpened on the truth. But even if the dirty businessmen get their wars, the truth's been told and will be known and grown forevermore. So if anybody doubts, look how Nero's remembered. Every lie finally leads to time and God surrenders. Yeah, while the refugees go do 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 do. Business, business everywhere runs the country through your hair. Lay my life on the line to dare all these posers everywhere. Business, business in your face, profit making every place. Even rebel music's laced. Time to give those fakes a taste. Who made business of the earth? Determined its godly worth. Time to put it in a hearse before this whole wide world bursts.
Now for something completely different.